Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He warns the Dow and NASDAQ topped out a few weeks ago and may be in line for a major correction. Meanwhile, the S&P 500 continues to hit new highs. Ross points out Apple continues to shine while the glimmer is coming off other Magnificent Seven stocks. Editor of Rick's Picks, Rick Ackerman, has some interesting targets for gold and silver and also some pivot points for those precious metals. He's concerned with so little real economic activity happening, we could be on the verge of a collapse that could mean bartering will replace money. He also believes Bitcoin is based on nothing and could end up being worth next to nothing. Publisher of thetrendletter.com, Martin Straith, talks about the impact of tariffs and where he believes interest rates and the stock markets are going. He also comments on President Trump's adventure into what many would call socialism. Martin also has a very special offer for our listeners. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
How would you describe what happened on the stock markets this week?
Well, this is more of the stepping higher in specific items. You take a look at the S&P. We've got intraday highs at new all-time highs. However, we got the Russell, the Dow, the NASDAQ, all sort of having topped out the better part of a couple of weeks ago and not having a lot of momentum right now. You know, of note, we've got some signals in the Dow and the Russell on the weekly charts that suggest we could be ready for a pretty good-sized correction. I think you need to be watching the lows that we put in the early part of this week. That was the first reasonable correction we've had in weeks now. You know, we had some of our oversold springboard readings in the middle of July and then early in August. And, you know, we've been walking up from that, holding the 20-day moving average. So that 20-day average is now held for, let me just check, 6 times now since we bottomed out in April. Typically, I look at any moving average like that. Once it's been tested 3 or more times, you then drop to the next longer one in duration. So that would be somewhere down around the 50-day moving average. Maybe the 20-week moving average. So for the S&P, that's a good 200 points below where we are right now. So, you need to be cautiously optimistic as this thing moves higher. We're in that time of year. One has to be very careful. September has not been a good one for the markets historically. So, tight stops, I think, for traders would be very reasonable right now.
What's going on with gold?
Gold and silver, we are looking at new all-time highs in this last week. And so that's both in the bullion and in the miners. The miners have continued to lead on the upside. That's been going on for months now. And we're starting to see excesses. We've got concurrent signals on the daily silver, gold, and miners that would suggest that we could correct back maybe as much as to the 20-day average. The miners themselves do have upside exhaustion readings in the GDX and in the SIL. So those are the stocks. And, this is all within the context where silver broke out back in May on the RSI, and the implication there is that we're going to rally dramatically, with an ultimate high being possibly into the first, second quarter of 2026. And we'd like to see a good run in silver, likely putting the RSI up around 85 or higher. So that would be part of an exponential run. So any corrections along the way here should be looked at as buying opportunities.
Anything happening with crude?
Crude is starting to give up some ground. The OPEC is talking about possibly increasing production rate again. The thing of note here is that seasonally we tend to see pressure from the this point in September right through the end of the month, and in many years that will stretch out into December. We would look for the weekly chart to put in a sequential nine. So that would be nine consecutive weeks with prices closing below 4 weeks earlier. That count is currently at five. So if we continue down at this pace, we could be looking at a potential low at the early part of October, but we'll see how that goes. It looks to be a little early to make that kind of a scenario come into place. But for now, the pressure is definitely there, and expect to see that continue for at least a number of weeks.
Is there anything else we should be keeping a close eye on?
Well, you know, with the move in the oil, that's having the effect on the Canadian dollar, which likes to move in the direction of the oil and the CRB index. So definitely some pressure to be seen, I would think, in the Canadian as we move through the next few weeks here. So keep an eye on those ones. On the other side of the coin, we've been looking at the agricultural market. The corn in particular put in a good buy signal that we reported on back in the third week of August, and that has now moved up to a two-month high, and I think that's still got potential on the upside here, so we'll see how that moves along. Another one on the upside has been Apple. That put in a good low with everything else in April, May. And at the 1st of July, we got confirming signals there for a buy signal. And since then, Apple's been outpacing the Mag 7 in particular, Microsoft and NVIDIA. And so, you know, you've got to take each one of these markets on its own, and the individual stocks should be looked at as well. So at this point, Apple's been outpacing, and I think that one should be looking to lock in profits on that move pretty soon here.
How's the U.S. dollar doing?
U.S. dollar, well, with the employment numbers that we got on Friday, it's starting to give up ground. It had been flirting around good support, tested multiple times. But as of now, that is seemingly giving up some ground here. We're at 97.70 as far as the spot index is concerned. If we close down through here, the trend, which had been looked as though it was potentially basing, is definitely giving up important support. The resistance had been at the 20-week moving average at 98.51. I think we still have to think of that as the major upside point here. But for now, trend is down in the U.S. dollar and up in all currencies except the Canadian dollar, which is being affected by the oil market.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Good to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Rick Ackerman, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. Where are you speaking to us from today?
I am in San Francisco, just assiduously avoiding the final throes of Florida summer heat. So I'm going to stick around here until I start getting good weather reports from Florida, meaning temperatures dropped out of the mid-90s. Anyway, it's beautiful here in San Francisco.
Rick, is there a possibility we could see 7,500 on the S&P 500 and 50,000 points on the Dow around the corner?
Well, anything's possible, Jim, and I did put out a forecast of few weeks ago that said I was looking for a 1,000-point melt-up in the S&Ps. I think the odds are still about 50-50 that that will happen, but that's kind of a downgrade from where I was before. I think we're just very, very late in the game. We're two outs in the ninth inning, and a lot of the momentum that was carrying the market forward, mainly exuberance over a lot of things that Trump was doing, are kind of fading, and I'm ready for a melt up, but I'm also let's say I've got one foot out the window and on the fire escape.
Gold hit new highs this week. Do you have any targets for gold?
Yeah, you got to love it. I'm looking at the October contract right now at 36.20. But I can see a minimum 37.19, and I would give you a go-ahead to around 4,100. Let me get the exact target here for you. It's not exact because I'm using a composite chart, but on the composite chart, I've got a nice path in gold up to, let me get this thing straight here, up to 4091. All right, so that's almost a 4100. That's about a $500 move from where we are now. All right, but there's one cautionary flag that I've just put out, and it's only because I noticed something this morning. That is that gold, the October contract, is almost exactly at a what I call a midpoint hidden pivot at 3607. It's a little bit above that, but it would be a good place to stall. And it happens to coincide with an equally compelling target, a hidden pivot target in silver. And this, again, is based on the composite chart, but I had silver looking at some potentially crucial resistance at $41.76 an ounce. That space is the September continuous contract. So we're right at this instant at a kind of dangerous spot in bullion, but if both of them move higher from here, I would say that we'll be looking at, well, it's gold at least 37.19.
What's the picture for the gold miners?
Well, GDXJ, which tracks the exploration stocks, has been going nuts, and it just missed a target I had up around 86. It came down so hard yesterday that I thought, well, geez, are we going to get to the target? But GDXJ currently trading 84.72. I think it's going to make a potentially important top at 86.41. We've been focused on that target for quite a while, and it reflects the fact that the miners have had a pretty good ride.
Does the U.S. dollar looks like it wants to go higher?
Well, it doesn't look like that at all, really. It's come down so hard. Of course, early in the year, we set a nice spiky high on the dollar index somewhere above 110, but we've since come down to around 96, so that's quite a significant move, and the dollar has shown no great eagerness to bounce from this this abyss that it's fallen into. So I see least somewhat lower values for the dollar. And it's saying something, you know, when you consider that Europe has kind of gone down the toity over the last year or so. Well, actually, since in the post-war period, but post-World War II period. But when you consider what the dollar is going, is being compared to say that the dollar is weak means that it's really weak. And of course, part of Trump's goal is to trash the dollar. He wants to create, I guess, currency conditions to favor U.S. manufacturers, to favor U.S. exports. So the dollar under Trump is really taking it in the shorts. And the same thing could be said of our Treasury paper. And even though I'm very bullish on the dollar long term and also on Treasuries, the unfortunate part of that is that we're going to see the bullish action only when we're much closer to Armageddon. So the strength in the dollar, in my view, has always been predicated on a deflationary event, a debt deflation. And you would discover that that the supply of actual dollars out there, which has been practically infinite for quite a while, would shrivel up in some sort of banking crisis. And effectively, you'd have a lot of people unable to roll very short-term loans that are denominated in dollars, and that would put a short squeeze on the dollar. So when I talk about a strong dollar, it's not in the normal way of things. It would be under extraordinary circumstances where we're experiencing a deflationary collapse.
Are the moves in Bitcoin likely tied to the stock market or commodities?
No, they're likely tied to mental illness. They definitely reflect mass psychosis. And I'm not particularly bullish on Bitcoin. I mean, I've forecast prices, I think, as high as 140-something or other, but we've had a little bit of a topping action over the last couple months in Bitcoin. So it's possible that the, I guess it was around 123, 124,000 high could be an important one. But ultimately, Bitcoin is, there's nothing behind it really. And no one can argue any differently that Bitcoin's intrinsic value is zero. And even though I would ascribe some value to Bitcoin based on the fact that it's a blockchain medium where you can record transactions securely, that only gives it, in my mind, maybe $2 or $3 worth of value, not a current $111,000 worth of value. So sooner or later, that fact is going to have to be reckoned with, that there's really nothing behind Bitcoin. And as I've mentioned before, when you ask one of the Bitcoin experts, well, why should Bitcoin be worth anything? Their six bullet points are scarcity, 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 and scarcity. And of course, scarcity is not money. It's a condition for money, but Bitcoin flunks on all the other conditions. So even though technically I'm always capable of seeing higher prices for Bitcoin, I'm not a believer in it.
Could the price of Bitcoin be reflecting the volume of money laundering?
No, I don't think so. Even though money laundering is the valuation of Bitcoin is such a fantasy that I don't think that anything connected to the real world could be driving the price. That it's almost like saying, do you think that transaction demand could be pushing Bitcoin higher? But the fact is, nobody uses Bitcoin for transactions. It's a purely speculative medium. So the speculation drives it hither and thither. But you would call that kind of a real world force that's pushing on Bitcoin, but it doesn't really exist. And in that sense, demand for Bitcoin arising from felons, institutional agents who are trying to hide great sums of money, that would have no impact at all on Bitcoin, because whatever they need to do those transactions, they can create an almost infinite supply, or an infinite supply, even though there's a limit on Satoshi mintage of 21 million Bitcoin. There are some corresponding cryptocurrency, so there's not enough real demand to push prices anywhere.
What's the difference between monetary inflation and price inflation?
Nothing. There's no difference that anyone can comment on knowledgeably. You know, when we talk about money inflation, or even go back to the days of the monetarists, they look like idiots now, or at least the ones that clung to the idea that monetary figures mean anything. The fact is, we have so many forms of money, fungible money, that it's impossible to measure money supply, much less account for the psychological factors that increase money velocity, that increase the demand, the turnover of these dollars. So it's pointless to try to measure it. Either monetary or price inflation is, the monetary kind is definitely a state of mind, and the price inflation, there are real world factors impacting that right now, such as the Trump tariff regimen and certain kinks in the supply chain. But even there, nobody can really comment scientifically about inflation, because if you take, let's take a loaf of bread, a price of a loaf of bread may have increased, it may have tripled. I noticed that Whole Foods is selling half loaves now for people who can't afford a whole loaf. And but I know I have a friend who he at one point he was the largest supplier, the largest baker of Italian bread in the United States. He had 125 trucks out in the New York area delivering bread, so he knows a few things about baking bread, and he said there's no reason whatsoever why the price of bread should have increased at all, much less doubled or tripled. It's just flour and water. So inflation in that way is, it's beyond measuring, or let's say commenting on in a knowledgeable, even pseudo-scientific way.
Well, in Canada, I think three of the major grocery chains were caught price fixing on the price of bread. And consumers, they got a $25 gift certificate in return for being ripped off for millions and millions.
How nice. And I'm guessing the lawyers got probably 100, 200 times that. That's the way class action suits work.
At some point, a deflationary bust makes sense, but so far the can has continued to be kicked down the road for years and years with more and more inflation. What could cause that trend to change?
Well, we're having, relative to the deflation that's coming, we're having kind of a tiddlywinks child play inflation. Sure, it's basically gutted the middle class of America so that nothing is affordable anymore. But that's a small thing compared to what's coming. You know, at the margin, things were becoming unaffordable anyway, and so it didn't take much of a tweak to raise inflation to the level of headlines. We see it, the headline stories all the time. But the deflation that I'm talking to will arise from a deleveraging of the bigger business of this country. You know, we're not just America, but the whole world. The world doesn't really like to get its hands dirty making actual things and selling them. It would prefer to shuffle paper. So even though we've got, let's say, a global GDP of somewhere, let's say, $160 to $180 trillion, somewhere in that vicinity, the amount of leveraged securities, all types of derivatives for one, aggregates into the quadrillion-dollar sums, in other words. And there, you could argue that, well, there's a lot of duplication of derivatives. But even if you settle on a really conservative figure, that the notional value of derivatives is, let's say, $250 billion, that's still many, many times the value of things that the world produces. So you could say that the main business of planet Earth is really just leveraging financial assets. And it begs the obvious question, you know, why do you need a $250 billion or $2 quadrillion banking edifice to service a real economy that's down there in the lowly $160 trillion range? So when all of these leveraged financial instruments, things that have been hypothecated up to the cosmos, when they start deleveraging, and it's only because the daisy chain that holds them all together has suffered some impairment. It could be, there's no predicting really, it could be that small bank in Cyprus that fails, and all of a sudden you've discovered that the Russian oligarchs have their money parked there. But it could be a relatively small event in a financial sense. It could be the assassination of the Archduke, but it's unpredictable. But something will happen to disrupt the clearing system that keeps this whole shaky edifice standing. And then a lot of zeros are going to get wiped off the books globally. We've got a macro ledger that contains all of the quadrillions of dollars of financial leverage, but the deleveraging will effectively remove that gaseous wealth from the financial system, and that's going to happen in a big way, in a spectacular way in the stock market. You know, I've written maybe a half a dozen times on how the valuations in the market, when we talk about Nvidia getting to be a $4+ trillion company, a lot of that wealth, I put that word in big quotes, occurred on gap up openings, where, and this is particularly, this is the operating style of the criminals who run Microsoft, the guys who handle Microsoft. You know, they'll start the day, the stock will end one day at 390, and then there'll be some news overnight, could be earnings after the close, and they'll gap the stock up $30. They did this in Google, by the way, a week ago when the court basically said, look, we're not going to make you divest your Chrome or, you know, your search engine, mainly because AI is already competing with you. All right, so they gapped Google up, I think it was 20 to 25 points, whatever it was, but it created 200, I calculated it was $212 billion of wealth effect that didn't even exist the previous day. And the fact is, no stock changed hands in that gap. It was just trading, you know, one price, one end of day, and then the next morning there was an overwhelming imbalance of buy orders over sell. So the specialists have quite a bit of leeway as to where they're going to open the stock, and they opened it much higher. So no stock changed hands in that gap, but at the new price, the higher price, somebody out there holding Google shares in their portfolio, they all made themselves a quick $212 billion. So I don't, there are two things that are inevitable. Number one, a bear market. Sooner or later, we're going to have a bear market. And when stocks come down in a bear market and start hitting these big gaps that took them higher for the last 16 years, we're going to have a problem here in Houston.
If President Trump is successful in ending wars, cleaning up crime in U.S. cities, and being on the right side of tariffs, could stock markets continue to move higher?
Well, they could, but I think the whole Trump exuberance over the things that Trump has done is kind of, it's wearing a little thin. In the first place, there was always a mismatch so that even if Trump's policy decisions were the right ones, and I do think he's done a lot of really good things, the idea of reshoring American manufacturing for one, in any way that you can. Of course, tariffs is just one way that you protect your domestic manufacturers. But the problem is that there's a really long lead time before that starts to pay off. We may get back our manufacturing, but it's going to take years, and it's going to take years. You can just imagine how long it will take for the average American worker to be making such significant strides with his paycheck that he will outstrip inflation. So the payoff of all these things that Trump is doing is years down the road. And in the meantime, he's gone for kind of a fiscal blowout with the idea, hey, we're going to see such amazing growth in this country that even with the additional borrowing that we're doing for fiscal stimulus, we'll make it all up. But that's not true. It's not possible. So we have a valley to cross between now, when Trump is implementing these policies, and 5 to 10 years down the road, when they really start to pay off, assuming they do. And I don't even concede the tariff point. There's no expert out there on earth who can really tell you what's going to happen with the tariffs. My own idea kind of borrows from David Stockman. Stockman made the point. He said, well, you know, if capitalism is working and this trade system is working and we're having free trade, why do we need a deal maker in the White House? So I guess you could justify the deal that Trump forced Europe to take as being in America's interest, but I don't think we should pretend that it's going to normalize global trade in a way that will make everything fair. Because in fact, even if it looked unfair based on the money flows that were involved in international trade, it was manifestly fair because the markets had all adjusted to all these tariffs. It's a crooked game, but everybody was used to the crookedness, so that you could say that in a perverse way, the markets actually were functioning before Trump laid a 20% across-the-board tariff on Europe.
In 2009, the Canadian government made bank bail-ins legal. Fast forward to 2025, and new Prime Minister Mark Carney is of central banking fame. Should Canadians be concerned the new Prime Minister could be an economic hitman?
Well, you know, the two sides of the coin. On the one side, we've had, let's say, the FDIC and CIPIC to protect securities investors. They're there, and we've known all along there's nothing there. There's no there that the FDIC could maybe handle 1.5 bank bailouts before it ran out of money, and all these stress tests are just a bunch of baloney. But when you come at it from the other direction, in other words, these FDIC is to protect the consumer. There is no protection there, really, not in really difficult straits. But coming at it from the other side, like the banks collapse, and what could we do to screw depositors? The bail-ins, it's such a great idea. I mean, that has to play in, the idea that the depositors of the bank are really going to share the loss. And I think that's probably what's going to happen. But fortunately for the depositors, they don't have any real assets anyway. When the stock market starts collapsing and what they have is the gold doubloons buried in their backyard, the bail-in artists are not going to be able to extort much money from the would-be bailer-inners.
The new U.S. Jobs report has just come in. 22,000 jobs created and unemployment up. The last person who was in charge of releasing the statistics was fired when they said there were 73,000 jobs added to the U.S. economy. Will the new jobs number czar be fired?
Well, I'm all for firing everybody, and I don't think Trump has gone too far wrong there. You know, anybody who's in the bureaucracy already, who's been there for a while, if they get fired, I think that's a net gain for all of us. So he's trying to kind of reshape the Fed so that it fits his designs. Lisa Cook has sued to not get fired, but of course we know she's going to lose her job because she's a liar and a plagiarist, and of course the Federal Reserve should hold its governors to a higher standard. So Trump is just being an autocrat and a dictator, and that's fine really, because he's for the most part he's getting rid of the bad guys, and if not a Fed governor who's not scrupulously honest, then it'll be some Venezuelan gang member. So anyway, I'm not coming full circle to the statistic itself, jobless or how many jobs were created. The numbers are all fiction. No one really knows. And even if they knew how many jobs were created, it would be impossible to gauge the economic significance of it unless it were a flood tide, really, of new hiring and new jobs, which obviously would help the economy.
Are there really two economies in the U.S., the upper class who pretty well, no matter what, are always going to have good times, and then the lower middle class, where, as you said, they're now selling half loaves of bread because some people can't afford a whole loaf?
Yeah, for sure. The country has become, it used to be a more even divide, but the American middle class was not so distant, really, from the material trappings, other than not having private jets. The average middle class American could afford the things he needed. But the divide has widened quite a bit, and the percentage of people who are at the top and not really caring, not even giving it a second thought if they buy a $1.5 million wristwatch or a $25,000 purse, things like that. They are spending like crazy, and of course that relates to the asset inflation that they've enjoyed as rentiers. They're not really there's a lot of passive income there, and it's much more significant than any income people are making with their own hands. So yeah, we've definitely got a two-tiered economy, but the top tier is it's a very thin stratum.
President Trump wants to have a return to heavy industry, aluminum smelting, making steel, and so on. But a recent survey found high schoolers in the U.S., 73% of them want to be influencers.
Right. And you know, that's a step down. We look at the young and we just kind of shake our heads like they've got to say they've got poor work habits is really a gross understatement. So they've somehow managed to take a few steps down from the moral and work ethic standard from they all wanted to be deal makers. They wanted to be MBAs in venture capital and this and that. But now with this idea that they want to be influencers, that's even more abstract and less get your hands dirty even than some investment banker. So yeah, we've been on a slippery slope for a pretty long time, and I don't know. I hope some of the kids figure out that they can't all be influencers. It's like the sticker I saw on some wall it asked the question "getting ahead," and the answer was "isn't everybody." So I would say it is funny. I mean, if your number is correct, which I assume it is, 70% of them want to be influencers. That's good, but even to be an influencer, it helps to have a primary skill like basketball.
Yeah, showing off your basketball spins. Also, return to heavy industry in the U.S. It's not going to be humans manning those steel plants, is it?
See, and that's exactly right. You know, even when Trump brings forward this idea about reshoring manufacturing, whatever happens, in order for us to be successful, the factories would have to be competitive with factories all over the world, especially the ones that don't pay their labor as much. So we would have to have quite a cost advantage in our manufacturing to make it worthwhile to reshore the manufacturing, and that's as much as saying these plants will have very few employees. So if they build a big steel factory, in theory, let's just you need a steel factory that can be run by five employees, and even the trains that bring you the raw materials to make steel, the process of mining and loading them will have to be less labor intensive. So I wouldn't get my hopes too high about all the jobs that are going to be created when Trump's reshoring efforts take hold.
Rick, what will, if deflation takes over, what will the economy look like?
We'll be bartering for bread, and there'll be a bread truck that comes, and some you may try to exchange your Krugerrands for a loaf of bread, and the guy will say, well, it's two Krugerrands today. And you'll say, well, what do you mean? That's crazy. It was just one Krugerrand yesterday. And the guy will tell you, well, you figure out yourself how to bake bread and get the ingredients for it. So I think we are going to be in a state of barter, and it's really unimaginable almost to think of what's going to happen, because when we went into the Depression of the 30s, this was a very different country. We had about 30% of the working population involved in agriculture, and that way you could say we were literally living off the land. We had real jobs. People's job descriptions were comprehensible, and people were not deeply in debt, and we knew how to fix stuff, and we weren't not turning out a lot of appliances and things that are only designed to last for 3 years. We were in much, much better. The dollar was also sound when we began the Depression. And so we were in much, much better shape back then to get through a Depression. But now, with our young people wanting to be influencers, you can see just how far far removed we are from the kind of resourcefulness we're going to need to get through hard times. But I think they're going to be hard almost beyond what we could imagine now.
Rick, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Yeah, and sorry if I had to, if I brought you down a little bit and bring your listeners down a little bit, but I do think that sooner or later you have to face up to reality that this bubble is not going to last, and when it doesn't last, what are things going to look like? So it will be people riding to the soup kitchen on $8,000 graphite frame trail bikes and things like that. We'll still have the infrastructure of a supremely affluent society, but only the trappings, you know, the rest of it, everything's going to be hollowed out. So anyway, I apologize for bringing everybody down, but it's time to get ready. The best place to find out how to get ready is to tune in on my friend Charles Hugh Smith, who a blogger of2minds.com, because he's not only getting ready, but he's doing all the right, it seems like he's doing it in the right way. He's growing his own food and doing this and that, learning how to fix things. And I think that's where you got to be.
Where can our listeners subscribe to Rick's Picks?
We've got a great deal. Just go to rickackerman.com, and up at the top there where it says free subscription, trial subscription, just click and you'll be instantly transported into the Rick's Picks world. A great chat room that draws some of the best traders from around the world. A lot of interesting discussion in there. But again, just rickackerman.com. Up top, one of the tabs is free subscription.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks. He was speaking to us from San Francisco. Coming up next, Martin Strath on This Week in Money.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Martin Strath, founder of Trend News Online at thetrendletter.com. He's speaking to us from Coquitlam, BC, which is just east of Vancouver. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Oh, my pleasure, Jim, as always. Good to talk to you.
What's going on with the S&P 500?
Well, it's lower today. We had the weak jobs, U.S. jobs data. But, you know, that could change as we, you know, we're in that phenomena of, you know, bad news is good news, you know, weak jobs. That adds fuel to the Fed to cut rates this month. The positives for the market, you've got the rotation to the small caps and home construction. And even though the S&P just hit another all-time high, the fear and greed index is actually neutral, which is, you know, that still means there's lots of room to run. The volatility index is down at 16, but that's not extremely low. It's down to almost 12 a little earlier. So it's not extremely overbought. So there could be room to run still. The 10-year yield has been dropping since May. Now it's down to 4.15 from 4.55. So again, lower rates. The market's kind of like that. The S&P 500 is trading. Now it's in an ascending wedge pattern here. And from the upper rung of that wedge goes back to the dot-com in 2000 from the high. Now, it closed Thursday right at that upper rung of the wedge pattern. So that's been a key resistance. It's down today. What are we looking? We're just at about closing. It's down about 22 points here on Friday. So now this doesn't mean the S&P cannot and will not push through that level. It just means that that's been an incredibly strong level for like 25 years now. So we're watching it really closely. So that upper resistance of the wedge, if it holds, then we should see at least a pullback soon in the S&P 500. Now, if the S&P pushes through that level, I mean, that would be very bullish from a technical standpoint. Now, if the S&P does break through that level, then we would want to keep it. It wasn't able to drop through it or push through it today. And if it falls down to the lower rung of that wedge pattern, which is around 63.75, then you really want to kind of sit up in your chair and take notice here. And if you've got a lot of profits, you've been riding this market, you might want to think about taking some profits and or, you know, looking to apply some hedges.
The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit recently ruled that most of President Trump's tariffs are an illegal use of emergency powers under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. If the U.S. Supreme Court upholds this ruling, what do you think would be the short and long-term consequences for investors, the markets, and U.S. trade policy more broadly?
Well, I mean, it would have significant legal, economic, and political implications. I mean, it would reaffirm, I mean, if the Supreme Court upheld this decision, it would reaffirm that the Congress has the authority to impose tariffs, not the president. You know, the Trump administration, they would be required, you know, to rescind or modify most of the tariffs they've already imposed since February. So we're talking, you know, all those imports on countries like China, Mexico, and Canada, they would have to pull those back. And then what about all the U.S. businesses that have been subjected to these tariffs? They might be eligible for some significant refunds. You know, the last I saw, the estimated so far in the tariffs is about $150 billion. So that was, you know, from the custom duties that have already been collected. And you can imagine that would create a big, large fiscal impact for Treasury. Well, you know, Trump's been bragging about all this money they've been bringing in. Well, if they had to give that back, that would be pretty big. And if you think about the future trade negotiations, you know, that ruling would really weaken U.S. trade position because that's been totally relying on, you know, Trump's tariff leverage. You know, he's been able to play the big bully, and he's been able to force countries to, you know, to give in. So if that got reversed, that would be very interesting. And then again, you know, for the U.S. small businesses that have been negatively impacted by these tariffs. So again, we're talking like these small cap companies we were just talking about. That would potentially benefit them and relieve some great regulatory clarity easing cost pressure and supply chain disruptions. And then you got the trading partners in countries like ours and Canada here that have been totally alienated by the tariffs. I mean, that would open the door for improving diplomatic relations and potentially restoring cooperation on trade and regulatory issues. So, and again, I guess, in, you know, for Trump himself, ruling from the Supreme Court, that would be devastating reprimand to him. And you know that that would be a huge blow to his ego for sure.
You recently posted an interesting chart on how AI can react to news items so much faster than we humans can. Can you explain what that chart showed?
Yeah, well, it's really no contest. I mean, you know, obviously AI algorithms versus the human. But the key was, you know, what I wanted to show on this chart, and I've seen it at a couple other places, but this was back on, you know, when Powell did his Jackson Hole speech. And at 10 a.m., the text of Jerome Powell's speech was released. Now, modern trading algorithms, they can parse, analyze, and react to such text within micro or milliseconds. And in comparison, you know, I looked it up on Perplexity. A human blink lasts between 100 and 400 milliseconds, meaning humans are about 1,000 to 10,000 times slower than AI at just registering the words on that speech. So that's only the beginning, because after reading the speech, the humans must then interpret and process what Powell actually meant. In the meantime, you've got these AI algorithm trading models, they've already reacted. So what the chart showed was that at 9:55 or 9:59 a.m., the S&P 500 was trading at 63.95. At 10 a.m., the text of Powell's speech was released. Within a minute, the algo models had already parsed the text, analyzed the content, and determined that the Fed was open to a rate cut. And so then these models executed buy trades. And so by 10:01 a.m., the S&P 500 was now trading at 64.65. So it was up 70 points in about a minute or so. And in the meantime, the humans were still reading the text. And, you know, so the humans, they haven't even comprehended what's going on yet, but they were then left to have to now react to what the algorithms had already done. And like I say, it's really no contest. And the chart I showed is quite stark. It's quite amazing. You know, if anybody wants to see it, just send us a note.
There's been a lot of conjecture around Trump trying to control the Fed, first by berating Chair Powell and now by firing voting member Lisa Cook. What's your take?
Yeah. You know, I mean, his criticism of Powell, that's pretty legendary. We've been seeing that for the last, you know, year, and well, even in his earlier term. And now the attempt to fire Cook, you know, it's putting unprecedented pressure, obviously, on the Fed's independence. And, you know, that is the kind of crucial, because it's, you know, it's important that you have a stable monetary policy. And clearly his efforts are aimed at forcing the Fed to cut rates faster for short-term political gain. And he's risking long-term economic stability. You know, undermining the Fed's autonomy, I mean, that can shake market confidence, increase, you know, financial volatility, politicize decisions that should be based on economic and data fundamentals. So if he succeeds in controlling the Fed, it's going to send a dangerous message, and it's going to allow future presidents to politicize monetary policy for partisan purposes. I mean, you know, all you have to do is look at Turkey back in, since 2018, I think it was. So Erdogan, he has increasingly intervened in the central bank's affairs, and he's repeatedly fired central bank governors who resisted his push for lower interest rates despite rising inflation. So he's appointed loyalists who share his rather unorthodox view that high interest rates cause inflation. Not lower interest rates. So his interference helped trigger a currency crisis and soaring inflation. So the Turkish lira has lost much of its value, and inflation in Turkey peaked over 80%. And the thing that makes me really wonder is, does Trump team not understand this? You know, you got Scott Bessent. I mean, that's his Treasury Secretary. This is a smart man. You know, he was a very successful, you know, hedge fund manager, but he was known for his aggressive investment strategies. So I'm guessing that he's pretty comfortable manipulating the Fed policies. And then you have to wonder, does Trump even understand the bond market? Because if you lower the Fed rate by 25 or even 50%, that does not necessarily lower mortgage rates, for example. Those rates are driven by the markets. You know, his tariffs, assuming the Supreme Court does not halt them, are potentially very inflationary. So when he applies tariffs to imported goods, it means that the importer must pay the tariff, not the exporting country he's trying to punish. So those importers then, they are now deciding how much of those extra costs are they going to pass on to the consumer. So now, of course, the importers are going to try and get the exporter to give them a better price, but there's no guarantee it'll even come close to covering the full cost of the tariffs. That means the consumer is probably going to pay more, and that the big risk there is inflation. So you got Trump's big spending bill, which significantly increases federal deficits, you know, injecting trillions more into the economy, boosting demand. And again, that's inflationary. Higher government spending raises borrowing needs. And that puts upward pressure on the interest rates and inflation. You know, so the combination, this is what Trump wants. He wants a combination of fiscal stimulus, being the spending, and monetary stimulus, so low rates. And that just creates a massive fuel for higher inflation. Kind of a long wind to take there, Jim, but I think it's a very dangerous scenario if Trump takes control over the Fed.
Last month on this show, you said you were watching for a rotation out of big tech and into small cap stocks. That seems to have happened in August. So do you see that continuing?
Yeah, the Russell 2000, so that's the small cap index, that is up about 9% since late July. So, you know, a little over a month. Well, the NASDAQ, so that tech index, it's up less than 4%. And then you got NVIDIA, which has been the tech darling. I just saw it's down 3% so far today, and it's up less than 2% since late July. So yeah, so we've definitely seen the small caps starting to catch up here. Now small caps and value stocks, like I say, they've recently outperformed, but they still remain undervalued. So there's still more room to move here. Now, according to the FedWatch tool, for September 17th meeting, there's about an 88% chance of a 0.25% cut and a 12% chance of a 0.5% cut. Well, a rate cut usually really benefits the equities and certainly especially the small cap stocks, as they need to borrow more to grow. So obviously lower rates really help them. One thing to remember is that September is typically a volatile month for stocks. So, you know, investors are watching for signs to see if the recent rally can hold. Now, as I mentioned, small cap stocks are much more sensitive to interest rates, but they're also very sensitive to economic conditions. So if we got concerns about stagflation, and stagflation means, you know, a slowing economy, but you still have rising inflation, that can really hurt the consumers, and that could really hurt the small caps. So that's something we're really watching. Now, if we get lower interest rates, obviously that should help smaller companies, but all investors need to understand that the Fed can only control very short-term rates. It does not control longer-term rates, such as the 10-year bond. So things like mortgages, multi-year loans, those are market-driven, not Fed-controlled. So small businesses, you know, they tend to require longer-term loans, you know, for equipment, financing, commercial mortgages, et cetera. And again, those are tied typically to longer-term interest rates, kind of to the 5 or 10-year yields, and not the very short-term rates that the Fed has the influence on. So longer-term rates are driven by market expectations of inflation, economic growth and credit risk, which may not immediately decline when the Fed cuts short-term rates. So history shows that the Fed aggressively cut rates, it usually means they're very concerned about the economy. Then again, a weak economy is not good for stocks, especially small cap. But, you know, if the Fed aggressively lowers rate because of pressure from Trump, well, inflation could be the result. So, you know, if Trump does get hold of the Fed, again, I said before, I think that'd be very, very dangerous. So yeah, these are very interesting times because the historic trends may not be as valuable to us if we get this kind of manipulation from the government.
President Trump recently had the government buy Intel stock. What's your take on governments buying into public companies?
I think this is really unsettling. You know, Trump ran on a platform of getting government out of people's lives. But his actions since being elected, I mean, he's done some good things, but a lot of this stuff has been really contradictory to what that theme was. You know, governments buying companies sounds a lot more like socialism to me than capitalism. You know, if you think about it, it reminds me of Trudeau, loaning tens of billions of dollars to the EV battery companies, one of which, by the way, Northvolt, is now bankrupt. Well, Trump's now invested $9 billion, and now the U.S. government owns 10% of Intel, which was a very poorly run company. So you're using taxpayers' money to support an inefficient company. I mean, capitalism doesn't reward failure. So, again, it's very contradictory to me, but that's not how capitalism is supposed to work. I understand he wants to ensure U.S. doesn't have to rely on other countries for semiconductors, but I really have concerns about government intervention in the private sector and the free markets.
What do you see ahead for the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Well, the U.S. dollar, again, that's the reserve, world reserve currency. It was in a steep decline. I think it was about 12%. It dropped from early January to the start of July. And again, when we look at all currencies, they're all connected. You know, if the U.S. dollar is rising, others fall. If the U.S. dollar is declining, the other currencies rise. But from the low in July, the U.S. dollar has actually been in a slight uptrend. And in early July, when I was on your show, I said I expected the U.S. dollar to rise, and that was primarily based on technical readings. And then I saw a tweet saying that the U.S. dollar was going to crash 40 to 50%. And there was a lot of hits on that tweet. And when I see that kind of crazy sentiment, that tells me we're at an inflection point. So for now, the U.S. dollar has been in that slow uptrend. Now today, we saw the U.S. jobs data came in much weaker than expected. I think the number was 22,000 versus 75,000. And the previous month was also revised lower, I think it was down 13,000. So that suggests almost certainty that the Fed's going to cut rates, and that would be negative to the U.S. dollar. But again, here's the thing I think every person needs to, understand. If you're an investor, you need to understand currencies, because if you understand what the currency's doing, that really affects, what all the other markets are doing. And in the big picture with currencies, people talk about the U.S. dollar is going to lose 50%. But in the big picture, all trade-weighted currencies are losing purchasing power together at about the same rate. So that means the U.S. dollar is losing power, the Canadian dollar is losing power, the euro is losing power, the yen is losing, the pound is losing. And those are happening at about the same rate. And again, that interconnection between the U.S. dollar moving one direction, all those other currencies tend to move the other way. But remember, the U.S. dollar is still the world reserve currency. Currently, we've got countries like the BRIC countries, they're trying to wean themselves off the U.S. dollar, but that's not going to happen overnight. That's not as easy as it sounds. So while it will be under pressure with rate cuts, etc., so will all the other global currencies. You think about the Canadian dollar. Look what's happening in the economy in Canada versus the U.S. I mean, Canada is in big trouble. the Bank of Canada is going to be lowering rates more than the bank or the U.S. Fed is going to be. The European banks is going to be lowering rates. So you have to just think about it. The way I look at it is the U.S. dollar is the least ugly house on the block. Now, if you look at the Canadian, like I said, it's all connected. We've seen the dollar has been rising slowly since July. Well, what happens to the Canadian? It's been in a downtrend since then. You know, today we got Canadian job data down. We lost 66,000 jobs. That's the second month in a row for job losses. The unemployment rate in Canada jumped to 7.1%. Well, the U.S. is 4.4%, I think it is. So the Canadian unemployment now is at the highest level it's been in since 2016, so 9 years. So the Canadian dollar is lower today with that job data at 72.23, next support 72. But like I say, all investors need to understand this relationship. It's all connected, heavily driven by what happens to the U.S. dollar. And if the U.S. dollar rallies, we're going to see the Canadian euro yen decline. If the U.S. dollar drops a bit, then we're going to see those other ones rise. But I think over time, as much as most people don't want to believe it, I think the U.S. dollar is going to remain stronger than most of these currencies.
Gold and silver have been hot lately. What's your take?
Oh, yeah. I mean, gold has been on an absolute tear the last few weeks. You know, it hit its all-time high in April at 3,500, and then it was just kind of meandering sideways until just the last couple of weeks. So, you know, we had months of it just trading in a very tight range, doing nothing. But it was kind of building momentum, and that's what you want to see. So it's certainly, since the last couple of weeks, gold's been on fire here. It's just trading right today at a new all-time high. Last I looked, it was $35.90. Now, gold is definitely overbought here. You know, you got the gold fear and greed index is at 87. That's an extreme greed level. The relative strength is at 77, where 70 is considered overbought. So again, that's extremely overbought. We've got Goldman Sachs calling for $4,000 gold. So again, now you start to get all the mainstream starting to jump in here. Now, Goldman Sachs also said it would go to $5,000 if Trump undermines the Fed. Now, which I think many people would suggest he's already done that. So sentiment is extremely high. Now, why is gold done so well? Well, of course, if Trump finally gets the Fed to cut rates, which everybody's expecting is going to happen, that's going to help gold. We know that central banks have been big buyers of gold to protect themselves against currency drops and global uncertainty. We know that governments are spending way more than they earn. They're piling up massive deficits and debts. That makes gold much more appealing as a safe place to hold value. And again, it protects purchasing power. Like I say, technically, it's very overbought here. Based on seasonality, September is quite a volatile month for gold. If we do get a pullback soon, near-term support would be about $34.50. And again, right now it's at $35.90, so just about $3,600. So you're looking at about $150, dollars down. You got near-term resistance at about $36.20. Now, longer term, I'm just very bullish gold. I hope we do get a nice correction so we can add to some of our positions. You know, some of our current positions have just done fabulous. You know, we've got UGL, which is a 2-time leveraged gold ETF. You know, that's up just about 100% since November or mid-November. We've got GDXJ, which is a junior ETF. That's up about 140% in the last couple of years. So again, doing very well. If we look at silver, it's making new highs. What are we at here? 41.05 today. So silver's up 40% for the year now. Now, 41.05, that's the highest level it's been since 2011, where it traded at its all-time high at $50. So supported by a combination, you know, we've got tight fiscal market. You've got rising industrial demand, so things like solar and electric vehicle sector. You've got macroeconomic factors, like low real yields and softer U.S. dollar. But like gold, silver is technically overbought here, so we could see a pause before the next big spike. But we are totally confident that the all-time high of $50 is going to be tested soon.
What about energy?
Yeah, well, you got, you know, if we look at oil, what do we have here? It's down about $1.85, so it's $61.75 right now. So we stated for quite a while that if it was just about supply and demand, oil would be much lower today, likely in the, you know, the low 60, mid to low 50 range. Now, we've seen recent spikes as early, you know, that early July jump driven by Middle East tensions. But as we saw, those tend to be very short-lived catalysts. The facts are simple. You got declining demand in China, soft economic data in the U.S., Europe, and Canada. Supply is not excessive, but it is on the high side. You know, if you look at seasonality, now we're in coming up, you know, we're still early September. So, you know, September can kind of be a bit of a volatile month. But when you get into October, right into the end of November, that is the weakest period for oil. So oil's been trading between 55 and 75, but that includes that $75, that includes that quick spike when the U.S. started bombing Iranian nuclear sites. Today, like I say, it's 61.75. If geopolitical tensions remain calm, you know, watch for a drop below 60. Like I say, mid-50s would probably be likely. Other than geopolitical event near term, I expect to see oil lower. But then around Q4, we're looking for oil to start move up. And I do expect to see $100 oil in the next 18 months or so. Now, we certainly don't want to hope for it. But, I mean, we really need to be prepared for an escalation of tensions. I mean, we just saw this week, we saw the, you know, the China military parade. We saw China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea form the Krink Alliance. You saw Putin and
Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, there you go. So they were there for the big parade to show all the new weaponry that China has. So again, anything's possible. So, you know, we've got to be prepared for that. So again, if there isn't any geopolitical tension, we're probably going to see oil get below 60. And if you look at the other big one we like, uranium, last I looked, price was 67.70. So it's still kind of holding most of the rally that topped out at about just under $80. Now, you've got the U.S. government signaled it's going to support domestic uranium enrichment capacity, cut regulations, accelerate licenses for reactors. And those are all positive actions for uranium prices. Uranium stocks have held up very well since April. So we're really big believers in nuclear and uranium, and we keep buying on pullbacks.
What do you see ahead for Bitcoin and Ethereum?
Well, I mean, one thing that investors need to remember is the cryptos are volatile. So Bitcoin actually has done very well during all of the tariff uncertainty. You know, it rallied from the April Liberation Day low of about, what was that, 77,000. It went up to about 112 in late May. And then it consolidated around 100,000 to 112,000 from May to mid-July. And then it broke out to that all-time high it hit in mid-August, and I think it was 124,000. But since then, it's pulled back. We just recently broke below its support level at 112,000, and it went all the way down to 107,000. Now, this week, we're seeing Bitcoin trying to rally here. It's right now, I'm looking at it, it's just, it's at about 111,000. So it's, again, it's now trying to break again that 112,000 resistance. And if it can break through that, then the next key resistance would be 117,000. Now, if Bitcoin cannot break through 112,000, then the bias would be to further decline. And that could probably take us down to 110, or basically 100,000 would be the next support level. Again, with all cryptos, all sectors, we watch those trend levels. You know, we need to watch these key support and resistance levels because they tell us what's happening versus what, you know, what investors' emotions, what they want to happen. So we do expect Bitcoin to become more of a haven play, you know, similar to gold. You know, we've got China wrapping up stimulus. That will be positive for Bitcoin. There's also the realization that so much government debt globally, fiat currencies are dramatically losing purchasing power. That's going to help Bitcoin. You know, you've got the U.S. M2 money supply. That is now at $22 trillion. You know, all they keep doing is adding liquidity. That eats away at the purchasing power of these currencies. That makes Bitcoin an alternative to fiat currencies, like I said, similar to gold. So what we're watching here, a breakthrough of 112,000 to 117,000. If 112 resistance holds, then we're looking for a pullback at 100,000. And then if 100,000 support fails, there's very strong support at 92.5. And that's for Bitcoin. So Ethereum, very similar, trading sideways from early May to July. But then as we discussed in your show in early July, Bitcoin really took off and we started to see companies create these, you know, Ethereum treasury strategies. We're also seeing more institutional investing into Ethereum. You know, if I'm looking at a Ethereum chart here, it's trading in a very solid uptrend channel that's been in since late June. It just recently tested the lower rung of that channel at about 4250, but so far that support level is held. If that lower rung is breached, well, then the support next level would be about 3900. Now, if the lower rung at 4250 holds, the next resistance for Ethereum would be the upper range, about 4955.
What's the latest with your new DeFi Digest newsletter, and is it still free for our listeners if they sign up?
Oh, well, yeah. There is so much going on in the DeFi space right now. Yeah, we've talked about our DeFi Digest for, I guess, the last couple sessions, last couple months. For those who haven't seen it or heard of it, so DeFi, short for decentralized finance, and really what that means is using blockchain technology to deliver financial services directly. So that means without the intermediaries such as banks and brokers. So anyone with an internet connection can access DeFi, and there's no paperwork, no accounting openings, you know, no traditional gatekeepers like banks involved. So it runs on those decentralized networks. So we're talking like Ethereum, and they use smart contracts. So that's code that automates and secures transactions between the users. So, I mean, again, I think I used the same example, but, you know, basically you're looking at the same kind of concept of getting in on the ground floor of a new financial revolution, very similar to what, you know, initial Bitcoin investors did, you know, well over a decade ago. You know, the opportunity is huge. You know, you've got major investment banks, you know, predicting $15 to $30 trillion for real world assets in the next decade. So what we're talking about is things like government corporate debt, commercial real estate, fine art, commodities. You name it. It could be from a Van Gogh painting to a commercial building. Now, example I always use is, you know, think of a commercial warehouse. Traditionally, only large companies or very wealthy investors could buy, say, a 30,000 square foot warehouse worth maybe $15 million. But with DeFi, the warehouse ownership can be divided into digital tokens on a blockchain, where each token represents a fraction of the building's total value or equity. Then these tokens are issued through smart contracts that automate the ownership rights, the dividend. So you're looking at, you know, say rental income distribution, voting powers, and proportionate to the token's holding. So if you own one token and there's, you know, 1,000 tokens, well, you have a very small percentage of the rent. And then the voting power. And the more tokens you own, the more part of the building you own, etc. So individuals from anywhere in the world can buy and sell tokens on decentralized exchanges without needing brokers, banks, or lawyers for each of these transactions. So you got the smart contracts are enforcing the transaction rules automatically. lowering costs, speeding up the process compared to traditional real estate deals that require all kinds of paperwork and lots of middlemen. So it's a natural progression. You know, as a society, we're already rapidly, you think about it, since COVID, shifting to online driven by technology convenience, you know, things like business meetings. You think about how COVID changed all that. Banking, investing, it's already into digital platforms. So you're moving these transactions onto digital DeFi platforms. So the next logical step in this progression, so early adapters are going to have that unique opportunity to capitalize on this shift, just as we saw, you know, when the internet back in 2000 and with Bitcoin. Now, there will be learning curve, just like early Bitcoin investors had to learn new technology and terminology. DeFi investors are going to have to master things like digital wallets, private keys, smart contracts. So you asked, you know, what are some of the developments? Well, just, you know, in our next issue of the DeFi Digest, it's going to cover things like Polymath. So that's a leading tokenization platform. They're going public in Canada later this year via reverse takeover. So they're going to, with analytics insight. So they're aiming to boost, you know, market visibility and institutional adoption, bridging DeFi technology with traditional finance. This is big. That's a very big step. You've got the convergence of DeFi with artificial intelligence is gaining big momentum, and that's enabling automation of decision making, yield optimization, simplified user experiences. You've got traditional financial institutions accelerating DeFi and tokenization adoption. So they're moving, you're talking traditional financial institutions are deploying capital into tokenization of assets and stable coins. We've talked about stable coins the last couple of times I've been on. Again, that's going to be a huge thing. So our next DeFi Digest newsletter is going to cover all of these developments, and it's going to help educate, provide guidance to help the subscribers work their way through the whole evolution of this new financial revolution. Again, as I said, the learning curves exist, but if you are someone who enjoys exploring new technologies and you want to be part of the next game-changing revolution, you really want to check out DeFi Digest. If you want to get on the list, you just simply email us at info@thetrendletter.com. We are not charging for this service yet. We will eventually. But right now, we're really enjoying the feedback we're getting from the readers. And that's really what we want to do, because we want to make DeFi Digest the go-to DeFi service.
Can you let our listeners know about your services and about the special offer you have for the premium paid services?
Yeah, sure. We've got six services now. So very quickly, you got the Trend Letter, 24th year. Publishes every week, every Sunday night. That's for long-term investors who want to understand what the markets are doing. It covers all these precious metals, commodities, and bonds. And it does make, you know, it gives you buy signals and sell signals for individual stocks, ETFs, etc. We got Trend Technical Trader, online service, updates about three times a week. It's for both active and long-term investors. It used to be a hedging service, but now it covers all the sectors. And it includes our proprietary gold technical indicator. That's about $650 per year regular. The Trend Letter was about $600. The third paid service is Trend Disruptors. That's speculative for risk capital that people have available. Invest in disruptive ideas. So we're talking AI, virtual augmented reality, 5G, cloud, Internet of Things. Again, that's for people that are really wanting to speculate. That's about $600 a year. But we do have some specials. I'll tell you in a real quick second. And then the free services right now, DeFi Digest, as we just talked about. We've got Market Pulse. So that's a market recap highlighting key market moves of the day or the week. Again, that's free. And then we have our headline service, where that's where we tell every morning, every weekday morning, we send out all the market news headlines that we think every investor needs to be aware of. And then the readers can just simply read the headlines, and if they want to see the details, they just click on the link and they can read the whole article. So if any of your listeners want to get in on any of that, or if they got any questions, what's happening in the markets, just email us at info@thetrendletter.com. And now we do have specials. So right now, Labor Day's over. Everybody's back from holidays pretty much. So we're just going to go offer a kind of a fall special here. That's 33 to 57% off. So 33% off each of our services. And then if you bundle up ones, depending on what you bundle up, you can get up to 57% off. So you just go to thetrendletter.com. Now, just a note, our site's hosting service is going through a major upgrade right now. So our site has been, it may be unavailable intermittently. So if you can't get access to these specials, just email us at info@thetrendletter.com and we'll send you a link so that you can get at it.
Martin, thank you so much for the update.
Oh, always a pleasure, Jim. Thanks very much for having me.
My guest has been Martin Straith, founder of Trend News Online at thetrendletter.com. Our conversation took place on Friday, September 5th. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Rick Ackerman, and Martin Straith. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.